You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we take the temperature in Mexico ahead of this Sunday's presidential election. Our Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg, has headed south of the Rio Grande.
The PAN vote is conservative, Catholic, business-minded, and 6 years ago, López Obrador was their greatest fear, and now he might turn out to be their only hope of stopping the PRI from coming back to power.
An illegal settlement in Israel's occupied territories is being demolished, but few Palestinians are celebrating. It may be replaced by a much larger one. We'll be heading to Tel Aviv to hear the latest. Turkish Airways is considering a bid for Ireland's national carrier Aer Lingus in the latest expansion plans for one of Europe's biggest growing airlines. We'll be finding out what it all means. And we'll also discover whether Cyprus is about to get a bailout and whether it will make a difference. And finally, yes, we'll be talking about sharks. Author and shark expert Juliet Elperin will be in the studio to discuss her new book, Demon Fish. All that, plus we discuss the business of fashion, and we'll also play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. But before any of that, let's catch up with the latest news headlines from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News, moments before finance ministers from the Eurozone's four biggest economies are due to meet for unscheduled talks. The European Commission President José Manuel Barroso has said today that far-reaching reforms were the only way forward to save the euro.
It needs to start following its own laws and abiding by the rules that our country has instituted and its legal system and its constitution granting equal rights to all of its citizens. Right now, that is not the case.
The Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Recep Erdogan has today warned Syria that Turkey will treat any Syrian military units which approach its border as a threat and a military target. Meanwhile, a search and rescue operation backed by naval helicopters is still underway for the missing pilots of a Turkish military jet shot down by Syrian forces on Friday. Turkey has rejected assertions from Damascus that its forces had no option but to fire on the F-4 jet. Syria claims it flew over Syrian waters. Turkey says it flew over international waters and has branded the shooting an act of aggression. President Jacob Zuma has said today that South Africa's economy is still mostly under the control of whites who held power under apartheid, and the government needs to take more drastic steps to make sure the black majority can benefit from its wealth.
Conference must deliberate on how the state can obtain an equitable share from the mineral resources and how communities can benefit more from this national resource.
He was speaking at the start of a major policy meeting of his ruling African National Congress, saying the challenges of poverty, unemployment and inequality pose long-term risks for Africa's richest country, 18 years after the end of apartheid. Pavel Khodorkovsky, the son of the former head of Russian oil giant Yukos, has visited the Council of Europe in Strasbourg today on his father's 49th birthday. Mikhail Khodorkovsky is spending his eighth year in prison after first being arrested on charges of tax evasion, fraud and embezzlement. His son said that continued support from Europe will help to ensure the safety of Russia's longest-serving political prisoner.
Russia needs to start following its own laws and abiding by the rules that our country has instituted and its legal system and its constitution granting equal rights to all of its citizens. Right now, that is not the case.
Prince Charles has met members of the Team GB Olympic sailing squad in Weymouth today, where Olympic sailing and windsurfing events will be held. The prince was shown around the venue by Team GB sailor Ben Ainslie, who is the three-time Olympic gold medalist in the sport.
I think it's great for everyone involved to have the Prince Charles down here in Weymouth and Portland at the Sailing Academy supporting the team so close to the Olympics. It's great to have someone of his stature here giving us that little bit of support.
And finally, Venezuela is demanding the return of the Quaker stone, which the indigenous Pomon Indians believe to be sacred. The German artist Wolfgang von Schwarzenfeld has argued in Berlin today that the boulder was a gift to him. He took the stone to Germany in 1997 as part of his Global Stone project, and the stone is currently on display in the Tiergarten Park in Berlin.
If this stone is taken away, it ruins the whole project.
With Caracas calling it a robbery and the sculptor arguing that it was a legal donation, the monolith is emitting more negative energy than its esoteric fans in Berlin would usually enjoy. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It is 20.05 in Helsinki, 18.05 here in London, and 10.05 in the morning in San Francisco. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. On Tuesday in the occupied territories, as the men of Ulpana performed their morning prayers, Israeli authorities pulled up alongside them in removal vans. Settlers began moving out of apartment blocks that Israel's Supreme Court ruled had been built illegally on Palestinian-owned land after reaching an agreement with the government to go quietly. As ever, though, in this part of the world, nothing is quite so simple. Ulpana is part of a larger settlement called Beit El, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered the construction of 300 new homes in Beit El. Joining us now on the line from Tel Aviv is Monocle contributor Joseph Dana. Joseph, thank you very much for joining us. Can you talk us through the specifics of this case?
Thanks for having me. So the specifics are, it's kind of a bit like musical chairs when you look at it from the international perspective. The Israeli Supreme Court, as you mentioned, ruled that the neighborhood of Ulpana was built on privately owned Palestinian land. It was an illegally built settlement. And so Netanyahu had to kind of bridge the gap and figure out a way of engaging with the international community, upholding this Israeli statute, as well as appeasing his settler base. And so the way that he did that is he agreed to move five major units, roughly 33 families, 3 kilometers down the street to a military base which has been set up as a temporary housing area. They're living in caravans there. And then he's going to build 300 new settlement units in the same area, which these families will be relocated in.
And now, in what way does getting rid of five homes and building another 300 in any way fool the international community, and particularly the US, that Netanyahu is serious about dismantling settlements?
Well, that's a very good point. It doesn't really fool the international community and the U.S. I mean, it should be noted that this is the first eviction of the current Netanyahu term. The last major eviction in the West Bank by an Israeli prime minister was under Olmert in 2008 in Hebron. And so it sends a message that the Israelis are understanding that the international community still rules Israeli settlements to be illegal and have not accepted them. And so the Israeli prime minister is in a very sticky situation, given the fact that his main constituency is a settler base, and yet he's not willing to completely thumb his nose in front of the international community. And so he's going to have to make some sort of action. But as you stated, it's kind of superficial to move a number of families down the street and then build 300 new settlement units.
In the international media, there's obviously been far more focus on Israel's relationship with Iran than its relationship with Palestine over the past 2 years, really. Has that been the same in Israel itself? Has the issue of Palestine and the settlers kind of been put somewhat on the back burner?
It is placed somewhat on the back burner. I mean, you have to keep in mind that the Israeli society is going through a series of upheavals right now. There's a large problem of African migrants, which now is getting to violent proportions, specifically in Tel Aviv, as you have Israelis attacking some African businesses and things like that. As well, you have the Israel social justice movement, which just this week, 89 people were arrested in Tel Aviv protests. And so there's a lot of internal internal dynamics which necessarily push the Palestinian issue back to the back burner. But that being said, the settlers still are a very powerful force inside of the Israeli government and inside of the Israeli body politic. And so they are continually trying to build new outposts. And so it's lingering in the background in terms of the Israeli mindset.
Now, the settlers are obviously a fairly strong political force within the current government coalition. Likud need them, so do those even further to the right. What about, you know, parties like Kadima and I believe there still is some sort of a Labour Party in Israel, not that we ever hear from it much these days. Do they have much of a take on this, which is different at all from Netanyahu's?
Not necessarily. I mean, one of the great interesting aspects of the Israeli political spectrum right now is that Kadima and Yisrael Beiteinu, two parties that are in the Likud hubris but are not Likud, are full of ex-Likud members. And so if you look at the Israeli parliament, you basically have over 80 seats of 120-seat Knesset, that are coming from a Likud background. And so the right, the center-right, has become the dominant force in Israeli politics with basically no reaction from the fledgling left parties like Labor and Meretz, which is even more far to the left.
Now, normally, if anything is really going to happen in terms of peace talks with Israel and Palestine, it needs to be led by the US. The US under Barack Obama has done very little, really. Obama sort of made a few sort of attempts to try and persuade Netanyahu to stop settlement building at the start of his term. He's kind of backed off somewhat since then. It hasn't really been an issue so far in the election. Do you get the sense that if Obama is re-elected, that it might be something that he returns to?
I think that there's a very real sense inside of the Israeli political spectrum that Obama in a second term is going to be much more of a force to be reckoned with. I think that Israelis understand that Netanyahu's behavior in the United States towards Obama has been less than respectful in certain periods of time. And so an Obama that's not facing re-election with a second-term mandate could try to apply much more pressure on the Israeli state to change its settlement policy, or at least to get something moving on the ground. What's going on here is status quo. And during the status quo, the Israelis are trying to very much entrench their occupation, as we see today with Alpana. They're doing movements that the international community would seem to welcome by relocating settlers, but they're relocating settlers inside of the West Bank, therefore, you know, establishing an even greater settler presence. And I think that people are afraid here that an Obama second term will be quite bad for this, and that there might be some more pressure from the United States.
And now, Joseph, you spend a lot of time in Ramallah as well. I mean, do you get a sense that on the Palestinian side of things, that they are angry about these sorts of moves, or just accept that, well, this is how things are at the moment and there's very little they can do about it?
There was a very crucial New York Times opinion piece last Sunday in which a writer from the International Crisis Group argued that a third intifada, a third Palestinian uprising, is basically inevitable at this point. And his argument was that Palestinians have lost hope in Israel granting them a state, that after the United Nations statehood bid and the continued entrenchment of Israeli occupation in the form of new settlements, that they believe that Israel is not a willing partner in this. And that if this sentiment, which I think is very much shared across the Palestinian political spectrum, if this really entrenches itself on the Palestinian street, then there's going to be an outbreak of violence as people basically say, well, what do we have to lose? Why are we cooperating in an Oslo framework that has no end? We can't trust the Israelis anymore. And so this is something that's very much apparent on the Palestinian street. And what's keeping a lid on it in a very significant way is a lot of the donor aid that floods into Palestine that keeps certain sectors of Palestinian society quite content, and they're able to ensure that the rest of the broader aspect of the society is kept in line. But it's not sustainable. And so I think we are very much, you know, going towards some sort of disaster, and it's just a question of when, not if.
Joseph Dana in Tel Aviv, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there on that rather depressing note. You're listening to Midori House.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Mexico goes to the polls this weekend to elect its new president, and the huge favourite is Enrique Peña Nieto of the Institutional Revolutionary Party. PRI's 7 decades in power were associated with corruption and repression, but Peña Nieto, a polished political performer and smooth media operator, appears to have shaken off his party's tarnished reputation. The leftist candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has enjoyed a surge in support of late. However, as Peña Nieto's opponents have sought to derail his seemingly unstoppable progress. A little earlier, Monocle's Tom Edwards spoke with Sasha Eisenberg, who's currently in Mexico. Tom started by asking what the latest opinion polls reveal.
Well, Enrique Peña Nieto, who's the pre-candidate, the party that was the ruling established in Mexico for 70 years and has been out of power for about 12 years, is leading by double digits in basically every poll. It's a four-person race, and probably his strongest competitor is Obrador, the man who lost to Calderon in 2006 and is sort of clearly the left candidate in this race. But it looks by all accounts like his opinion gets us to lose, and this sort of closing circuit of rallies that he's doing feels a bit like a coronation more than anything else.
You mentioned there that the gap in power for PRI, what would their return mean for Mexico, you know, over the coming few years? Is it something that a lot of the population will view with a sense of wariness? I mean, obviously he's very popular personally, but does his party have negative associations?
Well, he's done a lot to try to repackage himself as the new PRI, the sort of modern progressive PRI in many ways, trying to sort of shake off the reputation for corruption and sort of insider dealing. I think he seems like less of a threat, partially because he is a new face that has come on the scene entirely since 2000 and seems sort of unencumbered by the old history. And also it has been 12 years, and in the interim, the disappointment in the PAN, the party that Vicente Fox was part of when he was elected in 2000, that Calderon has served under, has just such a great sense of sort of lost opportunity that in many ways now the PRI is running against a new establishment and has, it sounds horrible to say, but I think they're sort of benefiting by the tremendous cynicism around the drug war and the sort of failure of the government to have both a consistent strategy against it or any real success at stopping the violence.
Now, you mentioned there, obviously, the drugs war. You alluded before as well to this spectre of corruption. I just wonder, is there a feeling in Mexico that, if anything, Peña Nieto can preside over what would almost be deemed tolerable levels of corruption? Is there a feeling that there's no real appetite to erase it from society, but he's a candidate who can make it bearable for people?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a kind of general acceptance of you know, that corruption is inevitable, that, you know, total eradication of drug culture in Mexico would just be fanciful, and in the parts of the country that have been sort of most ravaged by organized crime in the north and along the western coast, close to the U.S. border, there is I think some adjustment to the sort of realities of life under these conditions. You know, I think it also makes the kind of old corruption, the pure political corruption that the PRI was identified with, through the 90s, probably seem a little less troublesome in retrospect than, you know, allegations of drug cartels having having favorite politicians or cutting sort of protection deals with others. I mean, that starts to seem like it's operating on a sort of another scale of national urgency and probably helps people smooth over whatever their old resentments towards the pre-regime were.
And in terms of looking forward, whatever program we'll see from Peña Nieto, if he does indeed win, is there a feeling that despite the fairly robust nature of Mexican economy, it might be at risk under his watch? Is there a feeling that Mexico could find themselves, you know, heavily indebted in the years to come? Is that a fear, or are people so convinced by his personality that they're not so worried about these detail?
Josefina Vázquez Mota, who's the candidate of the PAN, Calderón's party, and more conservative sort of business candidate, would certainly like that fear to be urgent. But what's amazing about this campaign is how entirely void of actual policy conversation and general sort of ideology it is. In 2006, the race between Calderón and López Obrador really felt like, you know, contemporary Latin American election between a left and a right, that you know, the sort of specter of Chavez and nationalization on one side and the claims of, you know, American-style free market economics on the other. That's gone. Partially it's because it's a four-person race. Partially it's because you have these two sort of tarnished establishments waging against one another. But it does not feel like this is a debate over policy or over the sort of role of government in Mexican life or Mexico's place in the world. You have a sort of central personality, Peña Nieto, who has had such a short career in public life and doesn't seem to have any clear demerits against him. And most of the race has been his opponents trying to get a handle on a way of making that uncertainty about him feel ominous, and they've so far failed.
You mentioned there about this sort of specter of Chavez and how that has been associated in previous campaigns. I wonder, have you been surprised by López Obrador appearing to be something of a slightly more kind of unifying candidate in the recent few weeks? Obviously, a leftist, but it seems that almost he's galvanized a more popular support. Is there any sense of that? Do you see that, or do you think that's just misleading?
No, I think that's right, and I think part of it is the dynamics of this four-person race, which is that his only path to victory, I mean, part of it is taking down Peña Nieto's vote a little bit, but the clear path is making the anti-pre-vote that is currently with Josefina, with the PAN, come over to him. And I think that to the extent that there's, I think that everybody thinks that López Obrador is running a far more sort of disciplined strategic campaign than he did in 2006. It's far less sort of stubborn and impulsive than he was. And the sort of strategic imperative now is to coalesce whatever anti-pre-vote there is, which is now coming from both the left and the right. And to do that, I think he has to steer clear of the Chavista impulses and generally a certain type of populism that was his it's a very adversarial populism. It was a hallmark in 2006 because the PAN vote is conservative, Catholic, business-minded, and 6 years ago, López Obrador was their greatest fear, and now he might turn out to be their only hope of stopping the PRI from coming back to power.
Now, Sasha, I wanted to ask you about some recent events in Mexico City, surprisingly, in some respects. We saw three policemen who were killed in a shootout at the airport yesterday, investigating drugs corruption involving other officers, allegedly. What's the latest about that story, and how is that feeding into the race and the feeling of fearfulness generally surrounding the drugs war that seems to almost sometimes be out of control?
I mean, it's all over the papers today, and it does suggest a kind of encroaching on the relatively safe, stable Mexico, the capital, from the states where that type of violence is daily occurrence. You know, the candidates have slightly different ways of talking about the drug problem. Josefina, the PAN candidate, proposes increasing the police force three times. López Obrador is suggesting, far more of a hands-off approach. But it hasn't been a real source of engagement between the candidates. And one of the sort of peculiarities tomorrow, Wednesday, 4 days before the election, the campaigns have to go dark. And so we're down to sort of one day left for any of them to try to take this incident at the airport and make it part of a larger story. And there are no clues yet that anybody is interested in doing that.
That was Monocle's Sasha Eisenberg, normally, of course, in Washington, but currently in Mexico, speaking with Tom Edwards a little earlier. And you can hear more about our Mexico series. We can hear more about Mexico in our Mexico series on tonight's Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 hours London time. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Turkish Airlines may be a potential bidder for Aer Lingus, just days after rival Irish airline Ryanair made a surprise buyout bid, according to reports this morning. It is one of several airlines looking at Aer Lingus. Dublin is a desirable transport hub, able to connect with the Far East, and airlines such as Etihad and Ryanair are attempting to tap into this, but not without problems. To talk us through the possible bids and takeovers, and particularly Turkish Airlines, we're joined now on the line by Peter Morris, Chief Economist at Ascend Worldwide. Peter, welcome to Midori House. Why would Turkish Airlines be interested in Aer Lingus?
Well, Turkish Airlines has been growing at double-digit percentages and turning out profits each year. It's hit like every airline with the downturn that we've seen with higher fuel prices, but nonetheless, it is well positioned geographically between East and West and also with links to Africa. And I think that what it's looking is to get a foothold within the European framework. So in other words, within the EU countries, in anticipation probably of Turkey's accession.
And why, I mean, talking more generally, why has Turkish Airlines, you know, succeeded and able to grow in a way that so many other European carriers really haven't recently?
Well, there's a number of dimensions to it. I think they certainly would say that since being privatised, they have focused on the customer and that has produced its own reward. And there's no doubt that sort of quality of service and everything else is good. It's won various awards and so on. But I think the other element is the thing that always serves airlines well is geographic positioning. So it's in that region of the world that has been growing significantly, both from the point of view of Turkey and the Middle East, and indeed a sort of kickback from the whole oil price increase has been trends within that region. So it has had a confluence of factors that have come together, whereas the Europeans, for example, even though there's been that phase of expansion with low costs and so on, nonetheless, when GDP slows down, that inevitably hits airline traffic. And so Turkey has had that sort of virtuous circle of GDP growing, of being in the right place and being customer-oriented.
Now, Turkish had been looking at a possible tie-up with LOT in Poland. That they've now pulled out of. What do you think Aer Lingus gives them that, say, LOT didn't?
Well, one of the things about Aer Lingus is it has managed to survive in the Dante's Inferno that is Irish aviation. And that in itself is a real feather in its cap. You know, to have been in the founding place of Ryanair and to still be here after all that time, given the kind of competitive threat that Ryanair presents, that in itself is good. Then you look at its results, and although they certainly haven't been outstanding, it has managed to survive and turned in a profit. So, you know, it's doing something right, but nonetheless, aircraft operation and airlines is about economies of scale to a large degree. Aer Lingus needs to find that kind of economy of scale. And with a partner, that could be something that would help both sides of the equation.
If you were CEO of Aer Lingus and you had these various different offers potentially coming from Etihad, from Turkish Airlines, from Ryanair, which would be the one that you'd be recommending to your board? This is the route we need to be going.
I think in terms of customer outlook, in terms of product, in terms of desire for global expansion, the Turkish Airlines one would be interesting, particularly the links into the Star Alliance and so on, and opening up the East, because effectively Aer Lingus has got no links going eastwards to any great degree. So as a consequence, that's exactly what Turkish Airlines brings into it. And then the flip side of it is that Ireland is very well positioned for Atlantic traffic, and it's got this pre-clearance thing as well. So that's an advantage that it could bring. So I think in terms of the right kind of fit of product and people, the Turkish Airlines one I think would appeal to me most.
And if you're Turkish Airlines and the bid for Aer Lingus doesn't quite pull off, do you think you'd start looking around for other carriers in the region that might be able to help you, come up with that link to across the Atlantic?
Yeah, I think, but I wouldn't force the fit. You know, that's probably what happened with LOT, is that a number of things started to be a problem, and beyond a certain point, it just isn't worth it. It's sort of, should we do this on our own or do we do it with partners? And the good thing about partnerships in the airline business is each has got to bring something to the party. Otherwise, it just never worked for one reason or another.
Peter Morris, Chief Economist at Ascend Worldwide, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House.
This is Monocle 24.
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 Monocle 24. This is
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is 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 Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And in the next half hour here on Midori House, we're going to be discussing sharks and, you know, a bailout for Cyprus. Not at the same time, obviously. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. Finance ministers from the Eurozone's four biggest economies are due to meet for unscheduled talks, with the European Commission President José Manuel Barroso warning that far-reaching reforms were the only way forward to save the euro. The Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Recep Erdogan has today warned Syria that Turkey will treat any Syrian military units which approach its border as a threat and a military target. It comes as a search and rescue operation backed by naval helicopters is still underway for the missing pilots of a Turkish military jet shot down by Syrian forces on Friday. President Jacob Zuma has said today that South Africa's economy is still mostly under the control of whites who held power under apartheid, and the government needs to take more drastic steps to make sure the black majority can benefit from its wealth. Pavel Khodorkovsky, the son of the former head of Russian oil giant Yukos, has visited the Council of Europe in Strasbourg today on his father's 29th birthday, who's spending his eighth year in prison after first being arrested on charges of tax evasion, fraud and embezzlement. And Prince Charles has met teams of the members of the Team GB Olympic sailing squad in Weymouth, Dorset today, where Olympic sailing and windsurfing events will be held. Those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House. Coming up next... Yeah, sorry about that. But before that, this is Heaven by Emily Sandé, who's appearing at the Ho Festival in Arendal, Norway, later tonight. That was Heaven by Emily Sandé. It is 18:36 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Now, is it safe to go back into the water? From South Africa to Shanghai, sharks are still an object of obsession for many. We eat them, we hunt them. Most of us, come on, let's admit it, are probably still quite scared of them. Yet we can't necessarily rely on them always being around. In a new book that crisscrosses the globe, covering all shark-related matters, from the fin traders of Hong Kong to the shark callers of Papua, author Juliette Alprin examines why sharks remain nature's most awe-inspiring creatures. She joins me now in the studio. Juliette, welcome to Midori House.
Thanks so much.
Let's start with why you decided to write a book about sharks. Did you have an obsession with them as a child? Had you watched Jaws and thought, I want to know more?
Interestingly, no. In fact, I didn't even see Jaws until writing this book because I was pretty young when it came out and my parents definitely wouldn't let me see it. And I wasn't one of those kids who, for example, played those mind games of between a shark and a killer whale, who wins, you know, all those things. What I really do love writing about is the oceans. And so I feel like it's an area that's not really covered. And so when I set out to write a book on the environment, I knew that I wanted to write about the ocean. emotions. And so then I had to pick my topic. And I interviewed a lot of my sources and said, this is your moment to make the argument. And came to the conclusion that sharks would be fascinating because, first of all, they're globally distributed. So I'd be able to crisscross the world and see how people across geographic regions interacted with them. There's tons of new science coming out about them. And they're in peril. So I thought between all that and the fact that plenty of other people are obsessed with them, it seemed like a perfect topic for a book.
Now, during the course of your travels, you met some quite interesting characters. Could you give us a flavor of one or two of them?
Sure. And they really did range. I would say that two of the characters who really resonated the most with me are Salam Karsimbe, who's a shark caller in Papua New Guinea. Mm-hmm. And he's one of the last remaining people in the world who really has a faith tradition which centers on his relationship with sharks. And essentially, these are rituals going back hundreds of years where a few men in a few villages actually go out in one-man canoes, have a wood and rope contraption, ensnare a shark, and will engage in hand-to-hand combat and essentially bludgeon that shark and bring it back to the village to eat.
Great.
Exactly.
Did you join him on one of those trips?
I did. He did not, for better or worse, that he did not catch a shark the time that I went out on the water with him. And there is a whole thing about how women are bad luck. When you go, you're not allowed to sleep with your wife before you go out. And so I did ask whether it was my fault, and he was very nice and said, not necessarily, but he definitely does do it, and he doesn't even know his age, but in his 60s, one would presume, wiry and just convinced that he has the ability to do this.
Obviously, when you meet these sorts of people, who are experiencing sharks in a very different way that we might think of them in the West, what does that tell you about the beast itself and the way that people in different environments interact with it?
I think one of the things that it tells us is that when I looked historically at how people viewed sharks pre-Jaws, for example, and the modern era, one thing that's so interesting is that there are plenty of island cultures that did worship sharks, but most interestingly had a pretty nuanced relationship with them. They saw them as powerful, but not necessarily evil. And that's really one of the things that I discovered and found fascinating, that some of the people who are the most familiar with sharks don't think they're warm and cuddly, but have not demonized them to the extent that the West has.
And have we demonized them purely because of popular culture, because of films like Jaws?
No, I would say that part of it is we do have a primal fear of sharks, which is justified. And I think I tried to figure out, why is it that we're so much more terrified of sharks than, say, a grizzly bear or, a polar bear, for that matter, both of which can kill you. And I think part of it is that they can strike from the dark without warning, that really the unexpected nature of a shark attack is what worries us. But it's true that Peter Benchley, in writing the book Jaws, and of course Steven Spielberg directing that movie, I think that somehow captured it so well that it made everyone think that any time you got in the water, you weren't safe.
We think of sharks in a sense that they are a threat to us.
Right.
It's also arguable that we are quite a major threat to them too.
Absolutely. We kill tens of millions of sharks each year. And what's interesting is that, while the science is still emerging on this, you're talking about anywhere from, say 20, 30 million sharks to as much as 100 million sharks a year may be killed both accidentally and then intentionally.
And what is that doing to shark numbers globally? Is it having a really sort of serious effect?
It is having a serious impact. At this point, the International Union for Conservation of Nature estimates that roughly a third of all shark species worldwide face some threat of extinction, which is extraordinary when you consider that sharks are more than 400 million years old. So they predate dinosaurs, and yet this is the moment that they're in danger of disappearing.
You're already starting to see, there's some restaurants and hotels in Hong Kong which now say we're not going to serve shark fin soup. Do you think there's more of an understanding now about the fact that, while these may not be the killer mammals that we set out to sort of claim they are. They do need some protection.
Absolutely. I think the tide is certainly turning in certain places. And I think one of the really interesting things is, of course, what really will happen in China. As you mentioned, for example, hotels like the Peninsula have just, as of this year, said that they are no longer serving shark's fin soup, which is one of it's the real driver for the intentional killing of sharks. And even though this is incredibly important at business meals and at weddings, they are taking a stand and saying that the risk is too great and they don't want to contribute to it. So one of the real questions is this kind of push against shark's fins that we're also seeing in Canada, we're seeing it in the United States. Does it take hold in China, on the mainland, where you have the real driver of this trade?
I want to ask how you personally feel about sharks now and whether your attitude towards them has changed in the course of researching and writing this book. Are you more or less scared when you go for a swim in the sea? Do you see them as almost sort of cuddly creatures?
So I don't, I'm in between. I would say I am less scared, and sometimes I think I have a false sense of security. My husband's convinced that in some crazy bit of irony, I myself may end up dying from a shark strike, but I'm willing.
Think of the book sales.
It's true. It's true.
I mean, posthumous, but...
Exactly. At least my family would benefit. But I, at this point, I don't, I mean, it was one of the funniest moments when I was cage diving in South Africa and on the boat ride out there, I was scared of seeing great whites. And then when I got in the water and I saw great whites again, I think they're beautiful creatures. And so I was myself a little shocked that I did not have fear at that moment. But that said, I don't actually see them as warm and fuzzy. I basically see them as deserving of respect, which I think is a slightly different feeling to have about them.
Do you think, certainly in the West, that we'll ever change our attitudes towards sharks? Do you think that that image is so embedded in our popular culture that they will always be seen as these frightening things under the sea?
I think that obviously on a certain level, the fear will always be there. But what has been fascinating is I started out to write this book in 2007. And even in that time, I mean, basically kind of the shark lobby, for lack of a better term, was kind of tiny.
I love the idea of a shark lobby.
Exactly. And, you know, it was something that people really didn't think that much about. And the fascinating thing is just in the last year or two, I think we're really beginning to rethink the shark. And that's really a good thing.
Juliet Arprin, author of Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks, and leading member now of the Shark Lobby. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London and New York.
Now, every day on Midori House, we summon one of Monocle's editors from the editorial floor upstairs to come down to Studio One and talk us through what's in their section in the current issue and also what they've got coming up. It's Tuesday, which means business, which means Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw has, as if by magic, appeared right next to me. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hello, Steve.
Now, you've just been in Florence, in Milan. You're about to head off to Paris. Let's talk about Italy. Now seems as good a time as ever. How did you see Italy's role changing, given the fact it's in the midst of quite a severe economic crisis?
Well, I mean, it certainly was an interesting one, because the last time we, obviously the season's every 6 months, the last time we were over there was in January. A lot's happened for Italy since January. Certainly ahead of Florence and Milan, we were, the question everyone's lips was, how is you know, that international brand that is made in Italy, especially in the menswear trade. How is that standing up? What's repositioning? What's changing? So, you know, we started off at Pitti, which is Pitti Uomo, based in Florence. It's traditionally seen as the kind of launch pad of men's weeks. It's where people really go to kind of get the, you know, see the menswear industry turned inside out, get a feel, look and feel of what's going on. It's set in a fortezza, and you kind of see everyone from Okayama denim weavers to Italian kind of Playboy promotional bunnies all there showing, striking their stuff. So it's, I mean, it's a really interesting one. And then on to Milan as well, which is generally seen as the where the more kind of commercial side takes place.
And in both of those places, did you get any sense that this was an industry going through a bit of a change, in experiencing any sort of crisis, or, you know, is it sort of floating above at the top without really being affected?
Well, it's something that we've talked about a little bit in the check-ins that we had kind of live from the shows, both in Florence and Milan. Myself, Aisha was there, Tyler was there. So we've kind of touched on it. One of the stories that we hadn't really talked about, which I think is very interesting, is the changing role of Italy as a kind of manufacturing base, the kind of manufacturing might of Italy. There's traditionally places like Biella, Vicenza, the huge textile looms in these production areas have been dominant in making, you know, certainly the very kind of high-end materials used in menswear. This has changed massively. I was speaking to Fabrizio Savente, who is heads the office for Woolmark in Milan. Obviously, Woolmark is the label set up to kind of expand the quality and influence of wool globally. It's an Australian-based initiative.
And we featured them in our Australia special
indeed.
Back in March.
Yeah, in March it was the business lead there. So Australia still, it's 80% of the global wool industry. Traditionally, Italy was the destination for this trade. This is why the likes of Fabrizio are there, based in Milan. They work with big labels like Zegna, Loro Piana. Mm. So it was very interesting talking to Fabrizio, figures that I hadn't seen before. He was saying that just 7 years ago, Italy was still the biggest producer of wool globally, certainly the highest end wool. About 7 years ago-ish, they were overtaken by, who would you guess?
Let's say China.
It might be China. So China overtook about 7 years ago. So that's not necessarily surprising. What was surprising were the figures. So Italy was leading 7 years ago. China overtook. China now is 70% of imports. Italy's down to 5%.
Wow.
So it's this transformation in what Italy means. I mean, Italy as... It's made in Italy as a brand is, I think, pretty almost timeless, as long as brands, you know, defend their core principles. That really means something in menswear, certainly. Italy as a business versus a brand is in real trouble, certainly with the domestic market for buyers, for menswear buyers in Italy. It was gone, almost gone. And then you're looking at the production side with the, you know, with the imports of materials like wool absolutely plummeting. So, I mean, that was a very interesting one for us.
So the brands are still strong, but there's just not enough money in the businesses.
Exactly so. I mean, and this was another really... a big discussion that people were having now is that how do you, as Italy moves from, certainly it's looking at a period where business is going to look very tricky, how do you consolidate and protect the brand, and how do you make brand Italy, as we were saying, it's stronger than ever. There's you know, the holding groups in France, Richemont, PPR, they're snapping up Italian labels for some seen as for rather good deals, and certainly China's very interested in doing the same. And the exports of these brands have Ermenegildo Zegna doing very, very well this season. So brand Italy very strong. Business wise, how does this kind of relationship work?
And do you get the impression that the big companies, the big names you just mentioned, understand the depth of the problem?
I mean, I think certainly you're dealing with incredibly smart people here. I mean, so Fabrizio I mentioned, we spent a lot of time talking to Raffaello Napoleone, who's the CEO of Pitti. He's very knowing in what his event means for Italian retail. So Pitti, for listeners who maybe didn't check in with our shows before or aren't so familiar with the event, it's a trade show essentially, but it's the beginning of the season. It's not really necessarily where a lot of the buying gets done. That happens a little bit later on in the season. Normally that's seen as Milan, it's seen as Paris. But this is where people go to kind of get a flavour of the industry. And that was really what Mr. Napoleone, at least, was saying. That is the role of Italy as a kind of tastemaker, as a creative leader. And the kind of really smart brands are the people who are now trying to work out what that means going forwards as the kind of economic rug, if you like, is pulled out from under them.
And when, I mean, you were in Florence and Milan, and numerous Monocle letters have been in Italy over the past week, myself included briefly. When you looked at what was happening more generally in Italy, you were there at a time when Mario Monti, the Italian Prime Minister, was talking about how there's only a week to save the Eurozone, about how serious the crisis was. Did you get a sense this is a country in crisis, or did you see some other sort of quite promising signs?
I didn't. I mean, just kind of anecdotally from the feeling around Florence and Milan, obviously these are both cities that we're pretty familiar with by now. I've personally been covering for the last seven seasons, I guess, and cities that we've spent a lot of time in. I think Italy is a rather wonderful country in the sense that it doesn't necessarily, what's happening in the economy doesn't necessarily express itself on the streets. I mean, there was still this very kind of buoyant vibe. Again, though, Florence and Milan aren't necessarily representative of Greater Italy. Florence, you've got a market which is essentially, 10 million tourists a year versus a dwindling population who actually live there. I mean, it's a kind of Disneyland market. And Milan is home to these very, very strong luxury brands, which are only doing better and better. So I wouldn't necessarily say they're representative, but although buying from Italian domestic retailers was certainly down, I think the mood was good.
Excellent. Jonathan Openshaw, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. On Monday, Cyprus requested financial aid from its European partners as it struggles to shore up its banks, which suffered heavy losses on Greek debt. In doing so, Cyprus became the fifth Eurozone country, out of only 17, remember, to request financial aid. Joining me down the line now is Dr. Dimitar Bechev, Senior Policy Fellow and Head of the Sofia Office of the European Council for Foreign Relations. Dimitar Bechev, thank you very much for joining us. Let's start with the obvious question. Why do they need the money?
Well, they need the money, precisely as you said, just to shore up the banking system. The second biggest bank in Cyprus, the popular bank, is facing difficulties. Certainly this has to do with exposure to Greece, which is a big trading partner, commercial partner of Cyprus. The haircuts earlier this year, whereby investors in Greek government bonds had to take a great deal of loss, basically lent back in Cyprus in many ways. And as in other places across Europe, the government has to step in now. But obviously that has exposed a big hole and the fiscal balance. And now the government, having tried other options, including the European Central Bank, a debt for shares swap, and also turning to other big countries, notably Russia, which has lent a bit of money to the Cypriot government, now having exhausted all those avenues, has turned to the European Stability Facility. So this was expected. It was in the making for a few months now.
It has been the making for a few months, but I mean, I was in Nicosia about this time last year, and talking to bankers there, they were feeling quite good about how things were going. They said, look, we're nothing like Greece. We've actually had a lot of investment recently from Greeks who don't want to put the money in their banks. Was this just hubris, or have things gone very wrong very quickly?
I think that was just trying to manage expectations and control panic. But I mean, the truth of the matter is that contagion spreads pretty quickly. We've seen it elsewhere in Southern Europe. Economies that have, in a very different fiscal position than Greece, have taken quite a bit of a hit because of the Greek situation. And certainly there were real fears to do with the outcome of the elections on June 17th. Now that those have been allayed a bit, I think the mood has gone down. But I mean, the truth of the matter also is that next year, a good chunk of Cypriot debt is maturing. I think the Cypriot government faces about 2.4 billion euros in maturing debt in 2013, which makes it even more urgent to take those measures. And it might be a good moment now. I mean, timing is essential as ever, because the fears have somewhat gone down. I mean, it was much more dramatic 10 days ago in the run-up to the elections in Athens.
Okay, well, let's hope that this bailout, if it does come through properly, does work for them. That was Dr. Dimitar Bechev, Senior Policy Fellow and Head of the Sofia Office of the European Council on Foreign Relations, joining us live there. You're listening to Midori House. You were listening to Midori House, I should say. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today's show. Thanks to our producer, Dawn Trump. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Ben Jay. Up next, after the news at 1900 hours London time, it's this week's episode of Section D with Hugo MacDonald. And today we learn why Zurich topped Monocle's list of 25 most livable cities.
So within these arches, we find a lot of different shops and restaurants and also some social projects. This really became a social tool to interact between the different areas and to improve both.
That's all coming up on Section D right after us. And in 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller will be back for the Monocle Daily. One of the things they'll be talking about is how Brazil's greenest city is losing its way. Ted Kravitz will be sitting in this seat for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Until then, goodbye.